Last time we spoke about the beginnings of a Japanese counteroffensive on Bougainville, some action on the Burma front and New Guinea. General Hayakatake was under immense pressure to dislodge the American force from Bougainville. He unleashed a grand counteroffensive trying to break the American defensive lines. Both the Japanese and Americans began suffering heavy casualties, yet neither side wavered in their resolve. Over in the Burma front, the Galahad Unit, aka Merrill's Marauders, joined the British, American, and Chinese allies in pushing the Japanese back. There were some issues involving some friendly fire, but overall, the Allies were making gains in a theater where the Japanese had dominated for years. Then over in New Guinea, the Japanese were continuing to retreat to Madang. Things were going so terribly, units were now being deployed to defend the western part of New Guinea. Japan was simply not winning the war of attrition. This episode is Operation Thursday. Welcome back to the Pacific War Podcast Week by Week, and I'm your dutiful host, Greg Watson. But before we begin, I just want to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please, subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, if you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I just released a full documentary on the Battle of Attu, and it's quite a bloody one. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you can find exclusive podcasts. Over there, I just released a two-part series on the complete history of the USS Enterprise and her amazing service. Pretty soon, I'm going to be tossing up a poll for what will be the next subject, so if you join up quickly, you can participate. Things have really been heating up in the Burma front. General Mutaguchi basically tricked his own superiors into allowing him to invade India under the guise of Operation Hago and Yugo. This saw Japanese units advancing towards Imphal and Kohima. On the other side, General Stilwell's forces were advancing upon Mitkinya to the north, as General Slim's 15th Corps were clashing with Japanese in the Arakan region. Americans, British, Indians, Chinese, they were all performing operations to halt Japanese attacks, pushing further into Burma. But on top of all of that, what we need to talk about today is our favorite little child born from the crazy onion-eating man Wingate, the Chindits. All the way back in early February, Operation Thursday was in development. The operation was basically an extended version of the first Chindit raid. This time, it was going to come in two waves, with three brigades making long marches across the Chinwin. The first wave would go into the enemy territory, then 2 to 3 months later, the second wave would come in to reinforce them. There were large issues with the operation, namely a lack of aircraft. Aircraft were being used for the Arakan campaign and flying supplies over the hump. Chiang Kai-shek would not part with a single aircraft set to go over the hump, and not even Mountbatten had the authority to touch that issue. Regardless, Thursday would be authorized and its goals were as follows. To assist Stilwell's advance, to create favorable conditions for the Y Force to ford the Salween and to inflict maximum damage to the Japanese in northern Burma. Their primary targets were to be the Shuibo-Mitkinya Railway and the Mitkinya-Bamo-Indao Road. There would be four strongholds also designated. Piccadilly, Corny, Broadway, and Templecombe. The last one would be later renamed Aberdeen. The U.S. 900th Airborne Engineer Company would clear strips suitable for Dakotas to land. On February the 4th, Wingate and Stratemer, commander of the Eastern Air Force Command, issued the essential guidelines for Operation Thursday, stressing this raid would require the wounded being flown out from the strongholds rather than just being abandoned, as was the case with the first expedition. Stratemer added orders to bomb the stronghold areas prior to their establishment, though Wingate had instead favored diversionary bombings of Rangoon, Mandalay, and Bangkok. On February the 5th of 1944, Ferguson's 16th Brigade kicked off the first, from Lido, and the onlookers would remark that they looked like a mule train more than a commando force. There were elephants, 250 bullocks, 547 horses, and untold thousands of mules assigned to the operation. Ferguson's 4,000 men took 500 mules, fully laden along with them. They avoided Japanese forces by traversing exceptionally difficult terrain. It would be a full month before all brigade battalions crossed the Chinwin River. Their main target was Indao, although two columns were tasked to also attack the town of Nanqing in the Kachin Hills and 20 miles west of Kamang. Two gliders loaded with folding boats, onboard engineers, and gasoline were towed by air over the Chinwin River and softly set down on a sandbar. Not only were the necessities delivered to Ferguson, but also in terms of reuse, the pair of C-4As were plucked from the scene by a C-47. Wingate would travel with Ferguson and his men for the first part of the trek, up the grueling ascent to the Pak Tai. They faced mudslides, torrential rain, and the usual Burma experiences. It would take them all of February to reach the Chinwin. After that, it was another 200 miles to their target of Indao. Wingate departed after the first few days, but would come back over by aircraft to observe the crossing of the Chinwin. Ferguson had been quite critical of Wingate in January, describing him as a liar, but he continued to believe in the man. Wingate was sometimes wrong in small things, but never in big. When Wingate met Ferguson, he showed up with an entourage of war correspondents, trying to publicize the Chindit's activities. He began talking to the reporters about a new fad he came across, turtle eggs, which he declared provided singular nourishment. Like so many of Wingate's, we'll call it, eccentric ideas, no one favored this one. Turtles' eggs were found to be no more appetizing than those of any other reptile, and in fact, many of the Chindits experienced stomach pains and other digestive problems after eating them. Then Ferguson had to tell Wingate they could not possibly reach Indao earlier than March the 20th. The expectation had been March the 5th, thus Wingate was pretty pissed off. At the same time, the 1st Air Commando had performed an aerial reconnaissance over the three selected locations suitable for bringing gliders, Broadway, Piccadilly, and Chowringhee. Yet Wingate had issued strict orders banning any further overflights, fearing it would give up their intentions to the Japanese. Despite the warning, Colonel Cockrum dispatched a B-25 on March the 5th to perform a final look over the sites, giving last-minute reports that Broadway and Chowringhee were clear, but it looked like teak logs were sprawled all over the Piccadilly site. Since Piccadilly's site seemed unsuitable, Brigadier Calvert persuaded Wingate to send the gliders into Broadway. On the night of March the 5th, the gliders carrying the second wave were flown in. The Pathfinder gliders first touched down, set out flare pots to facilitate succeeding waves of other gliders. However, the field proved far less accessible than expected. For many years, the local people had logged teak, and during the wet season, slid the huge logs across the ground down to the river. Over time, the technique gouged deep ruts that elephants' grass covered, making the trenches invisible to aerial photographs or reconnaissance. Co-commander of the 1st Air Commando Group, John Rickardson Allison, recalled this. "They formed perfect glider traps. There was no way to avoid them. The gliders arrived overhead in large numbers, and when a glider starts down, there was no way to stop it. As each one hit the trenches, the landing gears would come off and the gliders would go in a heap. We tried to arrange the lights to spread the gliders over the field to avoid collisions, but this was impossible. They were coming in too fast to change directions, and glider after glider piled into each other while landing." The next day, gliders landed successfully on Chowringhee, and the airstrip was completed by nightfall. Meanwhile, transports began to bring Calvert's 77th Brigade, followed by Brigadier Lam Thang's 111th Brigade. By the 11th, the fly-in was complete. Now 9,250 Chindits were landed on the Broadway and Chowringhee areas. The Chindits then began their advance east to hit the Lashio-Bamo-Mitkinya motor supply line. Trekking from Chowringhee, Morris's force columns headed northeast to cut the Bamo-Mitkinya road, as the 111th Brigade's British battalions marched south from Broadway to link up with elements flown over into Chowringhee. Their job was to stop Indao being reinforced from the south. Thus, the 111th Brigade set up ambushes and roadblocks south of Indao, although part of the brigade, which landed at Chowringhee, was delayed in crossing the Irrawaddy River before moving west to Pinlambu. Broadway was held with a garrison that included field artillery, anti-aircraft guns, and some 6 Spitfires that would successfully repel a Ki-43 attack on March the 13th. Meanwhile, Calvert's columns advanced over the railway towards Henu, where they would establish the White City Stronghold, roughly 20 miles north of Indao. Columns were directed to demolish bridges and railroads around Kadu, Mahun, and Pinui stations. It was a long and gruesome march over some very tough terrain. For example, it took Column 45, bringing up the brigade's rear, 9 days to cover the first 35 miles, to Haklaka. They set out again on February the 22nd, but this time, the men were tiring of their K rations, which gave calories but no bulk. Smoking was confined to lunch and evening bivouacs. The Lesters were in the lead, and they reached the Chinwin on February the 29th. Meanwhile, Column 45, led by Reese, still in the rear, reached the Chinwin during the afternoon of Saturday, March the 4th. It had taken them 21 days to cover some of the wildest, toughest country on Earth. After successfully crossing the Chinwin, on March the 12th, Ferguson received orders to seize Indao's airfield, destroy some supply dumps in the area, and establish a new stronghold, to be known as Aberdeen. The brigade continued south, moving parallel and west of the railway. Meanwhile, Calvert's 5 columns took 5 days to reach Henu. The South Staffords were the first to arrive, and the Japanese reacted before they could dig in. They would have to fight for the block. And the Japanese were on full alert to resist their incursion. In the afternoon of the 16th, Calvert launched a bayonet charge at Pagona Hill. The Chindits soon engaged the Japanese engineers, who were charging down in a vicious hand-to-hand combat. Eventually, with the assistance of the 1st Air Commando's close support, the Japanese were successfully pushed off the hill, and the White City Stronghold was established. For the loss of 23 dead and 64 wounded, Calvert's Chindits had killed 42 Japanese and had effectively cut the line of communications off, supporting the 18th Division from the north. In the ensuing days, the stronghold would be developed into a fortress, with some airstrips becoming operational by March the 21st. The time chosen to drop the Chindits near the 18th Divisional line of communications was most embarrassing to General Tanaka. On January the 10th, headquarters of the 15th Army had suspended movement of supplies to the 18th Division in order to accumulate stocks for the projected attack against Imphal. Shipment was to resume as soon as the Imphal operation was underway. Then the Chindits had cut the rail line, and just when the supply movement was to be resumed, the 18th Division had to start living on what they had on hand in northern Burma. It was aided by the 56th Division, which shipped about 90 tons of vital supplies to the Makinya via Bamo. But Tanaka's supply position was fundamentally compromised by the Chindits fighting along the railway to northern Burma. On the 18th, Calvert's force took a large night drop, including wire and entrenching tools. They slaved away to turn the block into a fortress. The parachutes festooned across the forest canopy gave the block its popular name, White City, soon a maze of slit trenches and bunkers roofed with heavy timber. White City, with its commanding position, became a powerful concentration of force, with Calvert's 3 battalions steadily being reinforced. The block grew a heavily wired perimeter and a garrison strong enough to raise a substantial force for a mobile action. Calvert regarded White City as, quote, ideally situated around a series of hills about 30 feet to 50 feet high, with numerous small valleys in between, with water at the north and south. I brought the village of Henu into our defended area so that we would have a good field of fire across the paddy to the south. I also brought into the perimeter what we called OP Hill, a feature slightly higher than our own little hills, to give us good observation. Our perimeter was now about 1,000 yards long, mostly along the railway, and 800 yards deep. Calvert now had 2,000 men inside the block, while mobile floater columns operated to the north and south, together with a sizable force protecting Broadway. He called in airstrikes to punish the Japanese force at nearby Malu. Meanwhile, the 15th Army staff were beginning to panic. Many of the officers were beginning to see the paint on the wall. Many were calling for the Imphal offensive to be abandoned. General Mutaguchi refused to give up and instead directed some troops to thwart the Chindits. Yet in order to do this, a reserve battalion was taken from the 15th, 18th, 33rd, and 56th Divisions and redirected to Indao, while Colonel Yanagisawa Hideyoshi's 67th Regiment moved over to Nappin. Major General Hayashi Yoshihide's 24th Independent Mixed Brigade was ordered to advance north along with some units of the 2nd Division, who would open up a new HQ at Indao by March 25th. Further behind the lines, the 53rd Division, led by Lieutenant General Kono Etsujiro, were directed to rush north to engage the enemy as fast as possible. All of this was still a diversion from the main effort against Imphal, and it basically helped Stilwell's operations. To aid the war effort, the IGA Air Force was also stepping up their game. On March 18th, a Ki-43 raid managed to destroy some Spitfires grounded at Broadway. William Babe Whittemore and Alan M. Pert managed to get airborne, with both shooting down one Oscar each. Whittemore was shot down and killed, but Pert survived for over half an hour, holding off 20 enemy fighters. The remaining Spitfires were destroyed over on the ground for the loss of another pilot, Lieutenant Coulter. Pert flew back to Kangla the same day in his damaged Spitfire and reported what had happened. The following day, Ferguson's footsore columns finally neared Mountain Village, where they prepared to establish the Aberdeen stronghold. After an appalling final leg of their terrible march into Burma, with progress reduced at some points to 100 yards per hour, the 16th Brigade's elements finally reached Aberdeen, clearing some 60 miles west of Broadway's stronghold. The Aberdeen clearing was at Matton, just east of the Meza River and 25 miles from the railway supplying the Japanese 18th Division, still fighting Stilwell's Chinese troops at the time, and the 56th Division opposing the Yunnan Chinese. Aberdeen took in three villages, Matton, Calat, and Nong My. Aberdeen's site had a lot of advantages. It was only 2 days' march from Indao and 14 miles from the Indao-Mamak Road. The dominant feature was a hill at the northern end, where the permanent garrison would be quartered. There were, however, some drawbacks, mainly the fact that, as Ferguson himself acknowledged, it was, quote, highly accessible to the enemy. The 16th Brigade were exhausted, and they needed some rest. The planned attack against Indao would have to be delayed. To the south, the 21st Japanese launched a major night attack against White City. The battle was ferocious. Calvert Shinditz managed to successfully repel numerous attacks for over 8 hours until the Japanese finally pulled back. The Japanese had suffered an estimated 300 deaths. The Shinditz had also suffered heavy losses. In the White City perimeter, men took solace from the companionship of the animals sharing their hardships. A pony gave birth to a fowl during a Japanese attack and a murderous motor barrage. The fowl was named Minnie, after the nearby motor post. In another attack, Minnie was kicked in the eye by a panic-stricken mule. They fought to save the eye, and Brigadier Mike Calvert ordered regular reports of Minnie's progress to be circulated to all forward positions. After recovering, Minnie took to doing some rounds around the motor positions on the scrounge for tea, which she drank from a pint pot. Minnie survived White City and further battles and went on to enjoy a distinguished military career as a Lancashire Fusilier mascot. Minnie got out of India, traveled to Britain, and subsequently joined the regiment on tour of duty in Egypt. On the 23rd, leading elements of Brigadier Thomas Brodie's 14th Brigade began to arrive to Aberdeen with the task of blockading the Indao-Bamak Road. At the same time, the 111th Brigade's columns were ordered to stop Japanese movements along the Pinlumbu-Pimbon Road. The advance on Indao may have been compromised inadvertently by the movements of the 111th Brigade. One of its British battalions, the Cameronians, moved in, making a wide sweep west of Indao, crossing Batmak Road on the 22nd, with orders to cut the Indao-Hamala Road. They bumped into a Japanese patrol at night, and their two wounded were flown in by light aircraft the next day. The men became hardened to the realities of jungle warfare against the Japanese, who fought to the death. Some columns were luckier than others regarding their supply drops. For example, the King's own columns had a reputation for being very unlucky. During the 21st to the 23rd, three successive attempts to resupply them had all failed. Already, the columns were heavily reliant on food purchased in the local villages. Wingate then visited Bernard Ferguson at Aberdeen. Ferguson wanted to rest the 16th Brigade after its exhausting march, but Wingate had told him to press on to Indao before it could be reinforced. Unfortunately, however, the Japanese had already accomplished this. The 16th Brigade departed Aberdeen on the 24th, heading south of Okta, trying to get closer to the heavily reinforced Indao. Between them were strongholds at Thikyun Village. This part of the country was quite dry, and the Japanese controlled all the water sources. Thus, the Chindits were forced to fight to drink. Despite successfully blocking the Indaoba Muck Road, most of Ferguson's columns would get sucked into some heavy fighting around Thekunyin on the 26th. Only the 2nd Leicester's Column 17 and 71 made it to Indao, holding a toehold grimly until they were ordered to pull back. After 5 intense days of fighting, Ferguson ordered his men to withdraw and regroup at Aberdeen. Now back on the 24th, Wingate flew down to Broadway and White City on a morale-boosting mission to the 77th Brigade. After a side trip to Aberdeen, he flew back to Broadway and then on to Imphal. This would be the last time Calvert ever saw him. Wingate flew back to Imphal, landing at 6:23 p.m. before taking off again at 8 p.m. for Halicani Airfield. Half an hour later, the B-25 crashed into the Naga Hills due west of Imphal near the village of Thilong. Cochrane dispatched special forces to search for the crash, and they found it the next day. Everyone inside the B-25 had died instantly. Investigators believe the crash could have occurred from freak weather, engine failure, or pilot error. But since it was Wingate, there was an air of reluctance to accept it was just a mere accident. An official investigation concluded it had been the result of engine failure, and that the pilot unsuccessfully tried to return to Imphal. Yet other theories emerged, and they were tested out. Sabotage was the first, but it was ruled out because the B-25 had been closely guarded at all times, and nobody knew Wingate's intentions or flight plans. Thunderstorms and turbulence were cited as plausible, but all the pilots in the area confirmed there had been no thunderstorms that day. General Slim opted for extreme turbulence, even though the pilot's testimony also ruled that out. The wreckage was eventually found on the reverse side of a ridge, so that it was unlikely that the aircraft had flown into the hill. The most probable explanation is that it suddenly entered one of those local storms of extreme turbulence, so frequent in the area. These were difficult to avoid at night, and once in them, an airplane might be flung out of control or have its wings torn off. Another theory had it that the B-25's cluster bombs had broke loose from their bay, rolled into the fuselage, and detonated. Given, well, how Wingate was, many in the Indian Army rejoiced at his death. Some quoted Shakespeare's Macbeth. Nothing in his life became him like the leaving it. Mountbatten wrote this to his wife Edwina. I cannot tell you how much I am going to miss Wingate. Not only had we become close personal friends, but he was such a fire eater, and it was such a help to me having a man with a burning desire to fight. He was a pain in the neck to the generals over him, but I loved his wild enthusiasm, and it will be difficult for me to try and inoculate it from above. General Slim had this to write on Wingate. With him, contact had too often been collision, for few could meet so stark a character without being violently attracted or repelled. To most, he was either prophet or adventurer. Very few could regard him dispassionately, nor did he care to be so regarded. I once likened him to Peter the Hermit, preaching his crusade. I am sure that many of his knights and princes, that Peter so fierily extorted, did not like him very much. But they went crusading all the same. The trouble was, I think, that Wingate regarded himself as prophet, and that always leads to a single centeredness that verges on fanaticism, with all its faults. Yet, had he not done so, his leadership could not have been so dynamic, nor his personal magnetism so striking. And thus, there went Wingate, probably one of the most colorful characters of the Pacific War. In light of Wingate's death, General Slim promoted Letang to Major General and appointed him the new commander of the 3rd Division. Slim had loose control over the Special Force. He selected Brigadier Letang to be Wingate's replacement after conferring with Brigadier Derek Tulloch, Wingate's chief of staff. Letang was judged to be the most balanced and experienced commander in the force. He had been an instructor at the Staff College at Quetta, and he had led a Gurkha battalion with distinction during the grueling retreat from Burma in 1942, and he had commanded a Chindit brigade in the field. As an officer of the Gurkha troops, he had a similar outlook and a background to Slim. The other Chinda Brigade commanders were unknown quantities, mostly without staff qualifications, some of whom had never even commanded a battalion-sized unit in combat before 1944, and Wingate's staff officers lacked the necessary combat experience. The force's second-in-command, Major General George Sims, was bypassed by Slim and formally protested and asked to be relieved. Now, in selecting Letang, Slim did not take into account the tensions between those Chindit commanders and staff who were closely associated with Wingate. And Letang, who had a classical line officer's background, had been very critical of Wingate's methods and techniques. The loss of Wingate caused significant damage to the Chindits. It was as if they lost their persona. The month following Wingate's death, the 14th, 16th, and 111th Brigades appeared to lack direction. They stayed around Indao, ambushing the Japanese, but not doing anything else. As Slim would note, "The immediate sense of loss that struck like a blow, even those who had differed most from him, and I was not one of these, was a measure of the impact he had made. He had stirred up everyone with whom he had come into contact with." At Broadway, for instance, after days of aerial attack, the 2nd Battalion, 146th Regiment, stormed across the airstrip on March the 27th and attacked its lightly defended western perimeter. Thankfully, the attack was repulsed, partly due to superior numbers. 3 days of hard fighting at Broadway then ended with counterattacks and concentrated airstrikes finally dislodging the enemy. Though the Japanese regrouped, they were again pushed back by counterattacks supported by airstrikes in the end. Meanwhile, White City's defenses were strengthened. Dakotas brought over 4 25-pounders, 6 Beaufort anti-aircraft guns, and 4 2-pounder anti-tank guns. This would allow Calvert to attack Malu on the 27th. As a result, the village was successfully taken and burnt out with flamethrowers, with the Chindits then reducing the remaining Japanese strong points. By the end of March, however, several major changes were made at the highest level. Much of the air support was diverted to the critical battles of Imphal and Kohima, where troops were cut off and could only be resupplied by air. The 23rd Brigade, yet to fly in, was also dispatched to Kohima. Finally, the Chindits were formally subordinated to General Stilwell, who ordered them to abandon their dispersed operations around Indao and then to concentrate on interdicting the supply lines to the Japanese forces opposing his troops. In early April, while the 3rd West African Brigade and the remainder of Brodie's 14th Brigade were being brought over to Aberdeen, Letang ordered the 111th Brigade, led by Major John Masters, to advance north and build up the new Blackpool stronghold, which would block the railway and the main road to Hopin. To Calvert's disgust, he was ordered to abandon White City and Broadway to move north to support the new stronghold, as Letang insisted that the Chindits' brigades were just too far apart to support each other. But that is all for today on the Burma front, as we now need to head over to Bougainville. The counterattack on Bougainville shifted on March the 15th. General Kanda noticed Iwasa and Muda's units were struggling to break through their areas, so he changed the point of attack for the Magadha unit. He withdrew the bulk of the forces from Hills 700 and 260, sending them westward in preparation for a final attempt to break through towards Piva Airfield. The Reserve 6th Cavalry Regiment was sent to reinforce Magadha's rear, while the 2nd Battalion, 4th South Seas Garrison, was brought forward to try and contain the Americans at the Sawi River mouth. Thus, there was a 5-day break in the major action while the Japanese transferred the 13th and 23rd Regiments to reinforce what was left of Colonel Magadha's 45th Regiment. At this time, the Japanese maintained patrols, which sometimes got into firefights with American patrols. A number of Japanese were taken prisoner during these patrol actions. From time to time, the Japanese would lob mortar shells into the 129th sector. During this lull in the fighting, the tired American riflemen and engineers were busy strengthening the defenses. Pillboxes were rebuilt, tactical wire reestablished, illuminating devices were installed, communications improved, and many Japanese dead were buried. Information gained from prisoners and reconnaissance led General Beitler to conclude the Japanese would launch a major assault on March the 23rd. It was estimated that General Kanda had approximately 4,850 men at his disposal to renew the attack on the 129th front. Meanwhile, the American artillery was smashing the South Knob, and they were now only being defended by a screening force. On the 18th, General McCulloch launched a final combined assault against the Knob. Companies A and B of the 132nd Regiment performed an enveloping maneuver and enjoyed some initial success until they came upon heavy fire from the Japanese bunkers. At 2:10 p.m. the next day, the attack resumed, this time successfully destroying several pillboxes, but the Americans were halted short of the crest. On the 20th, Company B was reinforced with a platoon from A, and they circled the south end of the knob, reaching the base of the trail going east. There they discovered the Japanese could pour down just as much fire, seeing another failed attack. Because of this failure, it was decided to leave the reduction of Hill 260 to artillery and mortars. On the 23rd, Iwasa and Muda's units had completed their movement. Now, 4,850 troops were concentrated on the northern sector, ready to perform a major assault. Having been forewarned by captured documents, the American forces were expecting the attack. The Americans unleashed a heavy artillery bombardment against Magata's assault forces as they were forming up, disrupting their initial advance and causing massive casualties. Late in the evening, Kanda launched his own assault, with General Iwasa's 2nd Battalion, 23rd Regiment, and 2nd Battalion, 13th Regiment heading through the Cox Creek, followed by Muda's men. Advancing under the cover of darkness, the Japanese surprised the Americans and managed to knock out three pillboxes under heavy fire. The area of attack was so narrow, artillery and airstrikes could not be performed safely, so General Beitler ordered the 148th Regiment to respond with a combined tank infantry assault. With the support of Shermans and the Americans storming the Japanese positions at 7:25 a.m., they successfully reoccupied most of the lost territory within only 20 minutes. The Japanese tossed further attacks, but they were gradually being pushed from the narrow area by noon. During the afternoon, General Kruber's corps and divisional artillery began concentrating fire in a very narrow sector where the bulk of the surviving Japanese had dug in. An infantryman of the 129th recalled this:
"All of these big guns opened fire into the area about 500 yards in front of us. And I remember what they called a million-dollar barrage, and it's something you will never forget. The big guns shooting all over your head. It was very frightening, because you wondered whether one of these shells would not go far enough. It was all jungle out in front of us, and when they got done, it was all cleared out. They had knocked everything down. A lot of the Japs were killed by this. I can remember the day after the big attack, the bulldozers came in and dug out these huge trenches. We had to go out and take the Japanese and drag them into these. Because of the warm weather, they began to smell pretty bad. Many, many killed." It was the heaviest artillery concentration seen as of yet during the Pacific War. It completely disrupted the Magata unit, causing tremendous casualties. The 2nd Battalion, 45th Regiment was completely disorganized. The 1st and 3rd Battalions were reduced to 20 men. The 1st Battalion, 81st Regiment were reduced to 40 men. And the 3rd Battalion, 53rd Regiment were down to 100 men. The massive losses forced the Japanese to withdraw. General Hayakutake now realized his counteroffensive was a failure, and he was forced to call it off. The Japanese were in a full retreat by the 28th. The Magata force, with an estimated strength of over 1,500 men, utilized the Numanuma Trail and withdrew towards the northern part of Bougainville. The remnants of the Iwasa and Muda forces, covered by reinforcements from the 4th South Seas Garrison Unit and the 6th Cavalry Regiment, moved quickly along a number of trails to the relative safety of southern Bougainville. The units of the 17th Infantry Group returned to northern Bougainville and they rejoined its parent unit. On the 28th, the 182nd Regiment found the South Knob abandoned, and they finally secured Hill 260. The three-week battle for the rather insignificant knoll had cost the Americans 98 deaths and 581 wounded, and they counted 560 dead Japanese upon the knob. Total casualties for the final Japanese counteroffensive on Bougainville would be 263 American dead, with over 2,489 Japanese bodies counted. In reality, Hayakutake's 17th Army had lost a total of 3,000 killed and 4,000 wounded in their march operations, including 2,398 killed and 3,060 wounded from the 6th Division. General Beitler expressed the feelings of many in stating that the beating administered to the 6th Division was a partial repayment for its role in the rape of Nanking in 1937. Although the Japanese would plan another concentrated assault on Allied positions later down the line, they would never again launch a major attack. For all practical purposes, the battle for the Solomons was now over. But now we need to quickly jump over to the Southwest Pacific. As a result of the Admiralty Islands being invaded a month ahead of schedule, General MacArthur kept his gaze on the development in the Central Pacific. He needed to pick up the pace if he wanted to win the race, so he planned to carry out the invasion of Kaving by bypassing the Hansa Bay area with a direct jump to Hollandia before the end of April. General Sutherland gave the Joint Chiefs of Staff an outline calling for the Southwest Pacific Forces to move into Hollandia's area with two divisions on April the 15th, supported by the Pacific Fleet. Air, naval, and logistical bases would be established at Hollandia to support subsequent Southwest Pacific advances northwest of the Gilvink Bay region of Dutch New Guinea. The Southwest Pacific Forces would then move over to the Gilvink Bay area in June. In the middle of the next month, according to General Sutherland's presentation, three Southwest Pacific divisions would be sent against the Arafura Sea Islands southwest of Dutch New Guinea. Their air bases would be established from which to cover later advances to the Vogelka Peninsula and Halmahera, both scheduled for mid-September, when Central Pacific forces might be ready to move to the Palaus. If the Marianas were bypassed, however, the Palaus might then be invaded as early as mid-July. Land-based aircraft of the Southwest Pacific area could support a July invasion of the Palaus from air bases in Hollandia and Gilvink Bay regions. If air bases on the Vogelka, Halmahera, and the Arafura Sea Islands proved inadequate to provide left flank protection for the move into the Philippines, then an aerodrome site on Abon Island might also be seized in September or October. The entry into the Philippines was effectively dated for maybe mid-November against Southeast Mindanao. Yet, for all of this, MacArthur needed something he did not have, the Pacific Fleet's aircraft carriers. After concluding the Marshall Islands campaign, Admiral Nimitz argued that the next move would be to bypass Truk and invade the Southern Marianas and the Palos Islands to further neutralize the Carolines. To seize the Philippines, a good fleet base would be required in the Western Pacific. Nimitz proposed seizing Ulithi's Atoll, lying around midway between the Marianas and the Palau. Nimitz also argued the case for Wallai in the Carolines, 400 miles south of the Marianas. By early March, the Joint Chiefs of Staff thus met at the Washington Planning Conferences with Nimitz and Lieutenant General Richard Sutherland to hear about their plans to discuss what was the best course of action. In the end, on March the 12th, they issued a new directive for operations for 1944. The Joint Chiefs of Staff ordered MacArthur to cancel his Kaving operation and instead to complete the neutralization of Rabaul and Kaving with minimal forces necessary. The Southwest Pacific's forces were to jump from eastern New Guinea to Hollandia on April the 15th, thus bypassing Wewak and the Hansa Bay area, with the mission to develop an air center for which heavy bombers could start striking the Palau and the Japanese air bases in the western parts of New Guinea and Halmahera. Once Hollandia was secured, MacArthur was to conduct operations northwest along the northern New Guinea coast in preparation for an invasion of the Palau, and then Mindanao. The target date for the Southwest Pacific's landing on Mindanao in the Philippines was set for November the 15th. Admiral Nimitz, in turn, was ordered to cancel his Truk operation and to speed up the aerial neutralization of Truk, Wallai, and other Japanese bases in the central and eastern Carolines. He was also directed to conduct heavy carrier strikes against the Marianas, the Carolines, and the Palau, and to provide carrier support and amphibious means for the Southwest Pacific's landings in the Hollandia area. The Marianas would be occupied by Central Pacific forces beginning in mid-June, and the Palaus by mid-September. The Joint Chiefs were looking to extend Allied control over the eastern approaches to the Philippines and Formosa, and to secure air and naval bases from which to support operations against Mindanao, Formosa, and the Chinese coast. The invasion of the Admiralty and Green Islands led the Americans to seize full control over the South Pacific. This allowed the U.S. Navy to begin sending destroyers to harass the Japanese at Rabaul and Kaving. Admiral Halsey over at Guadalcanal assembled an invasion force to hit Kaving. When he heard about the decision to cancel the Kaving invasion, he searched for another task for the boys he had got together. He decided to capture the Emerald Island, lying halfway between Kaving and the Admiralties, thinking it could be the last link in an effort to strangle Rabaul. For what would be the last operation of Operation Cartwheel, Admiral Wilkerson put Commodore Reifsnieder in command of the amphibious operation, and he assigned Lieutenant Colonel Alan Shapley's 4th Marines to carry out the landing. As a preliminary, Admiral Griffin's Task Force 36, formed around 4 battleships and 2 escort carriers, also bombarded Kaving and its nearby airfields on March the 20th. The bombardment gave Rear Admiral Tamura Uyukichi the impression that the expected invasion by Allied forces was imminent, so he gave the order to kill all the European prisoners in Kaving. At least 25 of them were executed at the Kaving Wharf Massacre, which later led to 6 of the perpetrators being sentenced for war crimes in 1947. Sentenced to death by hanging, Tamura was executed at Stanley Prison on March the 16th of 1948. Meanwhile, Riefsnyder's convoy departed Guadalcanal in 2 echelons, successfully reaching the unoccupied Emiro Island at 6:05 a.m. The Marines of the 2 assault battalions, the 1st and 2nd Battalions 4th Marines, traveled on 9 high-speed transports with the remainder of the force on the dock landing ships Epping Forest, Gunston Hall, and Lindenwald, and the attack transport Callaway. 1 LSD carried 66 LVTs for crossing Emiro's fringing reef. 1 carried 3 LCTs, 2 of them loaded with tanks, and the 3rd carried 3 LCTs with radar sets and anti-aircraft guns. The LVTs were launched and the assault troops transferred to the amphibious tractors using APD boats, supplemented by those from Callaway, while Corsairs of VMF 218 flew overhead to make last-minute checks of the island for any signs of the Japanese. The assault waves touched down on schedule. The Reserve 3rd Battalion's boats grounded on the reef soon afterwards, and its Marines waded ashore through knee-deep water. The only problem encountered was the launching of the LCTs carrying the tanks. The LSD's flooding mechanism failed on the LCTs, and they had to be dragged over by Fleet Tug. While the detachment sent to occupy Alamosa Island was approaching the beach, some supposed opposition caused the amphibious tractors and then a destroyer to open fire, and a man was wounded by a shell fragment. After all of this was done, the Marines were told by some natives that Japanese had left Emiro 2 months before, and only a small detachment remained on Musa Island. Thus, 3,727 troops and 844 tons of cargo were ashore by nightfall when the ship sailed, and within a month, some 18,000 men and 44,000 tons of supplies had been landed, and it became a major motor torpedo base, and it would keep watch over the northern coast of New Ireland. As for the Japanese, Admiral Koga was planning to carry out a desperate program of reorganization, including the creation of a mobile fleet. Admiral Ozawa's first mobile fleet was formed by the 2nd and 3rd Fleets, consisting of most of the IGN's warships. This would leave the combined fleet as a mere administrative organization. Land-based forces in the Central Pacific were expanded, their main base was now Tianjin. Saipan was fortified, and it became the new fleet HQ. Fuel shortages and loss of tankers to submarine attacks had become so severe, Admiral Ozawa's new command would have to remain within the Singapore zone. They would operate close to the Dutch East Indies oil field and within Japanese waters for training. Admiral Koga was also preparing a new defensive plan, with the inner perimeter now extending from the Kurils to the Nampo Islands, and then the Marianas and the Carolines to the west end of New Guinea. He also drew up plans for the formation of a 3rd aircraft carrier fleet, in 3 divisions, each composed of 3 carriers. It looked very impressive on paper, but in reality, the 3rd division actually consisted of just 2 converted tankers, Zuiho and Chitose, and the converted naval auxiliary ship, Chiyoda. Furthermore, the carriers lacked any experienced pilots, with most of them having been lost around Rabaul and in the Solomons and Marshalls. Thus, new pilots for the 3 carrier divisions would have to be trained. Finally, he developed Plan Z, a strike against the American fleet the moment it entered the Philippine Sea. For this decisive naval battle, that in his eyes could allow the Japanese to win an honorable peace, Admiral Koga wanted to prepare to use 500 planes on carriers and another 500 on islands. So he needed to increase the Japanese air forces by over 50%, something that would be very hard to achieve. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, if you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I just released a full documentary on the Battle of Attu, and it is a hell of a bloody one.
Also, please check out my Patreon account over at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you can find exclusive podcasts. Over there, I just released a two-part series on the complete history of the USS Enterprise. And now I'm opening up the polls for the next exclusive podcast, so if you join up soon, you can take part. And with that, the South Pacific was liberated from the Empire of Japan. Operation Cartwheel was effectively done. The Allies were squeezing the Japanese Empire back into the home islands, and honestly, it was a good time to negotiate a peace on the side of the Japanese. But they would not do so, always on the search for the famed, decisive naval victory.